The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, Dillis Powell, and Dennis Norton. And round one tests their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. Beginning with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is tippy?
Dennis?
It sounds like a sort of northeast England dialect word of affection. She's my tippy.
She's my tippy, darling.
I know Joe.
He can't disprove it anyway, can he?
No, he can't really. Somebody.
Could you give us one of those extremely unhelpful hints?
Stick to what you might possibly drink.
Well,
very, very strong alcohol, it means.
No, you're almost entirely opposite.
Much
more tannin in it.
It's just to do with tips, you see.
Yes, that's it.
Tea. Yeah. It's just tea, we think.
Well, I helped you rather a lot.
Oh,
I think
no.
One and a half is fairly generous. Tippy is a word used to describe a kind of tea, the one that has the highest proportion of golden tips, which are the leaf buds of the tea plant. And I mustn't quote it, but there is one well-known brand of tea which sort of goes to town on this one. One and a half. Frank, now, what is whinstone? W-H-I-N and then stone. Whinstone or whin?
Whinstone. The little church on the hill. Is it the rock on which that stands, the church hill? The whinstone... The whinstone Churchill...
You're right.
No, it isn't, is it?
You're right. No, you're right about the rock, Frank, but where does it come from? And which bit of the country would you find it in? And what is it?
Scottish. No. Durham. Round about...
Well, that will work. Stick to the Pennine.
How? Stick to the Pennine. It's a form of stone found in the Pennines, which has peculiar properties which escape me at the moment. On the other hand, which you didn't ask me
but
for.
But whin grows on it, don't you think?
Whin?
I'll give you one mark for that. One out of two. It is a kind of rock. It's usually basalt. It can be a hard sandstone. And you find it up the Pennines where there's a great sheet of basalt called the whin sill. And one theory about how it got its name is that it might be the kind of very, very rocky soil on which only gorse, firs, whin could grow. So one out of two. Dennis Powell, what is a stiver? S-T-I-V-E-R, stiver.
It's a bit of money.
How much?
Very little.
Have a look. Two marks. Stiver is the smallest coin, a trifling amount. And it comes in phrases like to lose every stiver you possess or down to his last stiver. And it really comes from a real coin, a Dutch one called, I'm not very good at Dutch, but stiver, I think, which was a very small and now mercifully vanished Dutch coin. Now, Dennis Norton, the meaning of the word caseous, C-A-S-E-O-U-S, caseous.
It's too much to hope that it's some kind of clay.
No, it isn't.
I think it might be
well, I'm going on the on the whinstone principle.
Cheesy,
yes, I was thinking of what's that stuff they use for making cream? Casein.
That's right. Absolutely right.
It's some kind of chemical stuff that you have to put under the tap if you make sour cream, I believe, aren't I?
Absolutely right, yes. 2 marks. Caseous means of or like cheese or cheesy, and comes from casein, which is the protein of milk, which is the basis of cheese, without which you couldn't make cheese at all. 2 marks. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I hope the 2 women members of the team will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask where the quotations come from. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton, your quotation is, a new broom sweeps clean. And Dillis Powell and Frank, yours is, an ill-favoured thing, sir, but mine own. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. And so on to round two, which is a round of city titles or nicknames. For instance, we know that the city of the seven hills is Rome, and the city of the dreaming spires, or sometimes screaming choirs, is Oxford. For 2 marks, what city has got the following titles? Anne Scott James, the city of David.
What do you think? It's Jerusalem.
Yes, that's right. You could also hold it to be Bethlehem, because there is a quotation in the Bible, the city of David, where David was born and Jesus Christ was born. It's usually Jerusalem.
It could be Florence, actually. It's where, yes, where Michelangelo's David is.
Well, that's a good one, too, yeah.
Wouldn't it be a good one? I think we'll have 8. And we'll just sit out the next 2 rounds.
Ah, settle for 2. Frank Muir, Old Reiki. A-U-L-D and then Reiki.
Old Reiki is Edinburgh.
But why?
Well, because of the smoke.
Yeah, that's all right.
Which is the name for London.
Old Reiki was the old name for Edinburgh, and I'm sure it's a very clean city these days, but at those times it produced so much smoke that there was a mist or fog over it for a lot of the time. Dennis Power, the city of saints. And just to help you, I would go across the Atlantic.
Oh. San Francisco.
That's a good one.
St. Louis.
No, there are only one saint in each case, sir. That's no help.
Oh, you want
I want lots
saints.
Of saints.
Los Angeles. Well,
oh, yes.
Saints? Yes, yes, now.
I don't want to enter a theological argument with you, but saints are different from angels.
Well, that's very pernicious, also. Lots of angels.
Not
lots
the saints. Saints.
Lots of saints.
They might be the opposite of former day saints.
Latter-day
Saints? Yes. Mormons, Utah, you know. Yes.
Salt Lake City.
Yes.
Salt Lake City.
I'll give it to you, Salt
Without
Lake.
Without any help.
No.
1 out of 2 only. It can be Salt Lake City in Utah, the state of Utah, which was given this title because of the Mormons, so-called Latter-day Saints who lived there. But the normal one is Montreal in Canada, because all the streets in that city are named after saints. So it's City of Saints. Dennis Norton, the cities of the plain.
Cool.
Isn't that a biblical thing?
Yes.
Yes.
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Sodom and Gomorrah it is. They were the cities in the plain, and they were destroyed by fire or earthquake. The next round's about origins and derivations, and because this is a bit more complicated, we give 3 marks this time, because what I want members of the team to do is, first of all, to define the present meaning, and then to give me the origin or derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Anne Scott James, to swap horses in midstream.
Well, it means to change your goal or direction and switch over to something else. I mean, supposing you're decided to be a politician, you change your mind and think you'd like to be a miner. That's swapping horses in midstream.
Now, midstream, we've rather left out.
For some reason or other, it's generally taken to refer to the leader, to change the leader, whereas a horse would rear. I mean, truly, it would be the servant.
Yeah.
I've been using it wrong all my life.
And
have you?
And you don't remember the occasion on the origin of this phrase?
Well, it would be very unwise if you got into the middle of a deep river, wouldn't
you,
to change your horse.
That's right. That's the point. It means change your leaders at the height of a crisis, which is sometimes an ill-advised thing to do. But it's usually credited to Abraham Lincoln when, on the occasion when his fellow Republicans, although they were thoroughly dissatisfied with the way in which he wasn't winning the Civil War at that stage, they renominated him for president. And he said the Republican convention must have reached the conclusion that it's best not to swap horses when crossing a river. 3 marks. Frank Muir, Morris dance.
What was the question?
Present meaning and how it comes to have that.
Morris dancing is a dance. I knew the derivation of this now. It's a corruption, isn't it?
Yes.
It's very easy to get corrupted in village halls. Hot atmosphere and all the lights and the music. Just as country dancing is a corruption of contra dancing, because people dance opposite each other. You know. And it's a morose dancing, it probably is, and nobody seems to enjoy it much, do they? There's bills and handkerchiefs around their knees. And
you're getting awfully close, Frank. If you said Morisco rather than morose.
Morisco, French. No. Maurice. Mm-hmm. Mauritian.
No.
Moorish.
Yes.
My lovely partner suggests Moorish.
Yes, well, I helped you a bit on it. It originally was a military dance, and danced by the Moors, or Moriscos, and came here from Spain, as many things did, with our soldiers, after the war abroad, in the reign of Edward III. So it was the Moorish dance, and these were the Moorish or Morris men who danced it. Tell us, Powell, to square the circle. What do you mean now?
Do you know?
Yeah, this is navigation, isn't it?
Nope. Geometry.
Solve a rather difficult problem, I should think. Solve a difficult problem.
Well, you don't solve it.
You don't solve it. Mm. Not to solve it.
Attempting to square the circle.
Yes. Trying to solve a difficult problem.
And why is it difficult?
Well, you've
certainly... You tried.
Yes.
I want a bit more than that.
Well, it was doubtless a problem in Euclid, which was almost impossible. Quite non-erat demonstration.
1.5 marks for good Latin quotation. It means to attempt the impossible, or to perform a demonstrable impossibility. And the point is that it's impossible to determine exactly the ratio between the diameter and the circumference of a circle, and thus you can't construct a circle of the same area exactly as a given square. There is a figure for this which is called pi, 3.14159, but it doesn't stop there. The next decimals would be 26537, but it then goes on ad infinitum. In fact, you can't do this. You can't have a square which is exactly the same area as the circle. Dennis Norton,
yes.
To turn turtle.
It means to capsize, to turn over.
How far?
Completely.
Yes.
And it means to look like a turtle on its back.
Yes, I think that's it. It means to turn completely over, upside down, topsy-turvy. And this is the doubt about it. It could be, it's usually used of boats, because when they're turned upside down in the water, they're pretty helpless. In the same way, if you turn a turtle upside down, it doesn't know what to do next. But there is a very old word called turb, and an old English word called turflion, which simply means to row. It's possible that the turtle gets its name from this, rather than this phrase coming from the turtle.
Yes.
Question with the chicken and the egg. We come now to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, and Scott James, can I have the origin of your quotation? A new broom sweeps clean.
Well, I think it's just a proverb, Jack.
It is? You wouldn't know who put it in his book of proverbs. There aren't very many of these.
Everybody has to think a book of proverbs.
Is it that man called Hayward?
Hayward, well...
Hayward,
yes,
who did a book of proverbs?
Absolutely right. 2 marks. Now, do us Poe, the origin of yours, please. An ill-favoured thing, sir, but mine own...
Shakespeare, something.
Yes.
Shakespeare. As you like it.
Act 5, Scene 4.
As you like it.
Yes, remember who said it?
Act 5, Scene 4. It's one of these things because it's a misquotation, and about 1895, in the early days of this show, we had a round of misquotations. You know, it's a small thing that my own people usually say.
Yes.
And I always remember this. It's Act 5, Scene 4.
Yes, you're absolutely right. All right, give you 2 marks. Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And for this round, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norton and his quotation, A New Broom Sweeps Clean.
I don't know if you've been to any weddings lately, but here you have. You notice that something new is taking place. The latest thing is instead of having those ordinary wedding photographs, well, what people do is they have a cine film. And I don't quite know why this change has taken place. I've sort of worked out a theory that it may be that in later years, the husband can get a sort of bitter pleasure out of taking this cine film and putting it in the projector backwards. So that in the end, he walks away a free man. Anyway, as I have a cine camera, I've been in pretty much demand over the past couple of years to take these kind of wedding films. And so I've been present at some pretty strange weddings, of which the weirdest was last summer.
And this was a nudist wedding. You see, I didn't know, actually, that it was going to be a nudist wedding. I got there sort of bowled out, pitched up to this sort of country house place, and I saw these girls standing about. And what I thought, they'll never get mini skirts shorter than that. Because I can't even see them. And then somebody explained what the sort of occasion it was, and everybody there had to strip off, including me, which I did, and after some initial uncertainty as to where to put the white carnation, I joined the rest of the guests. Now, I must point out that it was all very dignified. It was this very secluded house, well set back from the road. It did seem a rather natural and rather beautiful way of having a wedding, except for the best man. Now, quite apart from the fact that at a nudist wedding, the very phrase, best man, takes on a debatable aspect. One problem arose, which I was very curious about. And in fact, it's a question which could be put in one of those intelligence tests that they always give people these days. Where, at a nudist wedding, does the best man keep the ring? Well, I'll tell you, actually. He keeps in the same place as he does in any other wedding. Well, obviously not in the waistcoat pocket itself, because they don't wear a waistcoat, but in the same anatomical location. How? With a length of sticking plaster. I was very intrigued by this, but it was explained to me that this is actually a very old nudist custom. And I'll tell you something else about that custom. It doesn't work. When it got to the part, will you place the ring upon her finger, the best man reached to this anatomical location just below the left lower rib cage and placed in the hand of the bridegroom an empty length of sticking plaster. Well, of course, there was absolute chaos then. Pandemonium didn't just rain, it absolutely poured. And it was magnificent for me with the cine camera, because I don't know if you've ever seen about 50-odd distinguished-looking ladies and gentlemen searching the grass down on their hands and knees, all completely startled. But if you have, you will realize it is very much a cinematic image, which I took advantage of. Anyway, they went scrabbling around for about half an hour, after which time they thought, well, heaven knows when we'll find it. So they proceeded by borrowing from me a metal ring, which I used as a lens cap. And the couple were wed, and we went into the house and had this sort of champagne reception. And the last shot in my film shows the bridegroom as the shadows were lengthening across the lawn, tramping up and down the grass with a vacuum cleaner on a very, very long lead, grimly and methodically searching in vain still for the lost ring. In fact, it was such an effective scene that I used this proverb of John Heywood's to caption that particular last reel. A nude groom sweeps green.
A charming picture, but absolutely no prizes for telling Dennis where he can put his carnation. And we go on to the other story from Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "An ill-favored thing, sir, but mine own."
One of my pleasures in life is strolling through the streets, talking to people, if the mood takes me. One day I was walking along with a very agreeable stranger, and we walked along together for a while, and he suddenly said to me, Tell me, why is it at Broadstairs High School in 1929 you failed to win the Maud Skeffington Memorial Prize for clay modelling? I would like to answer that question. In 1929, I was about nine, and passing through an unusually revolting stage. I'm now 6 foot six, but then, of course, I wasn't. I was only nine, and I was only 6 foot three. On the other hand, let me tell you something of the other actor in this drama, Ethel Pennyquick. I came across a photograph of her recently. I was clearing some rubbish, pushing some rubbish aside in the loft. A relation of my wife was coming to stay for the night, and I found this old photograph of her. She had a curious look on her face. It wasn't gamine. It was fey. It was, what's the word? It was gutsy. She loved eating. She had she was about eight, and my pleasure in life was to take her to the pictures. Now, the big bonus of the year was the Maud Skeffington Memorial Prize for clay modelling, which I always won. And the prize was a fountain pen to the value of 5 shillings. Now, a fountain pen to the value of 5 shillings is worth 5 shillings, so I could flog it for 4 shillings and feed up my madam, you see. Now, Maud Skeffington was a lady given to good works and overpopulated gardens, and she set the subject, which was things like Tinkerbell the fairy, a sad newt, and this particular year was a happy gnome. So this was child's play to me. Out with the plasticine, I knocked up a very happy gnome indeed. Long ears, cherubic smiling face, nice rosy cheeks, nice green pointed hat. Patched away in a bit of wrapped up newspaper in a cardboard box, and prepared to escort Ethel Pennyquick to the pictures. Now, unfortunately, I hadn't any money, and I had no food, so I decided to make some Turkish delight. This called for camel's milk. I couldn't find a camel, but I did find a humpbacked cow, oddly enough. So I had this cow's milk. You warm it up, and you mix it in with gelatine, and you add this, you boil it actually with gelatine. And the effect was really rather exotic. So I made a box of this, pressed it firm, it's rather peculiar consistency, went off to meet Ethel in the pictures. I sat there sort of red with embarrassment at having a girl next to me and watched the film, and she champed away at my Turkish delight in the darkness. Back we came. Following morning, time to take in my award-winning model to the headmaster. Picked up the box, phone rang. Ethel Pennyquick's mother. What has happened? Ethel has been taken off to hospital. I'm afraid it's a stomach pump job. They've got to get a pound and a half of plasticine out of her. Box under arm, I thought, wait a minute. Undid the box, and in the box, no model gnome, but a beautifully set batch of Turkish delight. I realise I'd taken my box, my model, and fed it to Ethel Pennyquick during the pictures, and she stuffed it down her stupid self and was now in hospital. Well, of course, it's absolutely hopeless. I had no time. I was on my way to school to make a decent model, and so I rushed out into the garden, got a beetroot, stuck half a carrot on its silly head to look like a red hat, stuck a couple of currants to make eyes, peeled a big potato for the body, stuck that together, rushed it to the headmaster. He looked at this and said, what is this monstrosity with scarlet fever? And I said, well, what could I say? Sir, an ill-fevered thing, sir, but my gnome.
By your vote, ladies and gentlemen, the contest of the two stories is won by Dennis Norden, and he and his teammate, Anne Scott James, also win the entire contest, and this brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.